Time to take a look at climate and weather with one half of our weather guy crew today. Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, our guest, and John Martin is elsewhere today.
Yeah, he won't be coming in today. He's probably, I know he's not enjoying the weather. He's doing stuff that you got to do when you got to do it.
Understood. Well,
be a great weather to be, great weather for being outside and hanging outside, though. Jeez.
Yeah, and it's, you know, still so dry over a lot of, many parts of Wisconsin. Some parts of Wisconsin got a lot of rain, but what creates these dry conditions?
Yeah, mostly, most of the state is below normal precipitation for July, anywhere from 60% below normal up to maybe about 90% below normal. So it's been it's definitely been a dry year for a dry month, and particularly up to the northwest of Wisconsin is really dry. And dry in both, you know, you could look at droughts in a variety of ways. One way is agricultural, in terms of its effect on agriculture, in which case it's not just how much rain you're getting, but when you're getting it and also what the temperatures are. And then you can get a hydrological drought in terms of, and there we just want water in streams to run power plants and things like that. And this year we're doing both. We're doing bad in both.
Yeah, we sure are. And if you look at the lakes around northern Wisconsin in particular.
Yeah, Lake Superior. Well, the lakes in general in Wisconsin are down low, and Lake Superior is almost at a record low. So, yeah, the precipitation has been not very good for us. So this is what I like to think of as vacationing weather. You know, people come up and they enjoy it and then they leave. But if you're going to live here and you're going to have gardens or anything that depends on water, it's not such a good summer.
Let's talk about clouds for a minute. The standard system for classifying clouds, I was looking at a book, actually. It's called Camp Out, and it's the ultimate kid's guide. But it's got some kind of neat things about clouds in it. And it reports that the standard system for classifying clouds was based on one devised more than a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah, by a fellow named Luke Howard, I think, or Howard Luke. I'm pretty sure it's one of those combinations.
Mr. Howard or Mr. Luke, one of the two. So how are they classified?
The classification that we ended up adopting, and by we I mean meteorologicals in general, are based on kind of two general things. One is altitude, and then the other is whether or not it's layered or puffy looking. And so usually layered type clouds we often refer to as stratus, because I guess somehow in Italian it means layered in some way. And then the altitude is generally characterized by, for high level clouds, cirrus, and those are usually composed of ice. Middle level clouds are alto, and low level clouds are again stratus again. And so if you listen, once you know that, if you just listen to the cloud types, you can kind of pick out what type of cloud it is. So like a cirrostratus is a layered high-level cloud.
Okay.
Whereas a cirrus cumulus or cumulocirrus would be a high-level cloud, but it's puffy in appearance instead of layered in appearance.
Okay. And the low clouds, they can get what? Up to about 6,500 feet?
Yeah, about 6,500 feet. Yeah. And that kind of changes a little bit in terms of where you are. So actually the closer you get to the poles, the lower that gets in altitude. In terms of the classification of the low-level clouds.
Oh, okay. So they could be much lower at the poles, you're saying?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
And then the high-level clouds are ones that are probably above 20,000 feet or so.
And clouds, we take a middle-level cloud. That'll run from, what, about 65 to 100 to 20-some thousand?
Yeah, probably about 20, maybe a little bit more.
They will contain literally billions of droplets.
Yeah, yeah.
As well as ice.
Right. And those are they don't occur as much as you might think in terms of if you just casually observe clouds. We usually get a lot of low-level clouds. It's bimodal in distribution. We get a lot of low-level cloud and a lot of high-level cloud and not a lot of middle-level cloud. But those middle-level clouds are really kind of interesting in terms of their structure. And as you were saying, they're often composed of both ice and liquid. And so generally, we don't want to fly through those. Because usually it means that liquid is probably below freezing. It just hasn't frozen yet. It remains in liquid. And so if it touches aircraft, it'll freeze right on the aircraft.
And the high clouds can go up to 40,000.
Yeah, yep. 40,000, 50,000. Even some Well, tops of some thunderstorms in the Midwest will go up to 60, 65,000 feet.
What? Are they the clouds that produce these kind of orange, red, yellow?
Yeah, no, they're the ice clouds or the cirrus clouds in general produce a lot of optical phenomena. So when you see rings around the sun and bright spots, sun dogs on either side of the sun, those are generally made by the ice crystal structures within the clouds. The red skies are often generated when the sky, when the sun is low in the sky, and then the atmosphere and the pollution, if you will, is removing the blue lights. And then the clouds reflect the reds and the oranges. So cloud particles are big enough that they'll pretty much reflect any wavelength of light that's incident on them, any color. Whereas the atmosphere, molecules in the atmosphere, they like to redirect and reflect the blues and the violets, and leaving behind only the reds and oranges.
And I'm usually up at around sunrise, and we've seen a lot of red skies.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Red sky. Red, I'm thinking of how that thing goes. Red sky is night, sailor's delight,
yeah,
red sky morning, sailor's
take
warning.
Where's the rain? Yeah. Because I'm not seeing any.
Yeah. And so that's where that saying tends to break down. And the reason why it's breaking down is we're in a summertime type weather pattern. And so in the weather pattern we've been having, there's basically is no weather.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, our guest today. I have a climate or weather question for him. Give us a call. Here's the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Paul in New Berlin. Paul, hello.
Hi. I know that the El Nino La Nina effect, so the weather, you know, worldwide, very profoundly. Have they figured out what causes the El Nino and La Nina so that that can be forecasted?
Not really. And by that I mean once the El Nino starts, you know, it's not going to impact our weather for a couple of months. And so we could actually observe it happening and therefore influence or forecast what our wintertime conditions might be, for example, if we pick up an El Nino occurring. But we kind of have a chicken and the egg problem here, and that is that what causes the El Nino is that the warm waters that are in the West Indies region kind of sloshes back to the eastern Pacific. And that happens when the easterlies in the tropic, the easterly winds in the tropics weaken. And so which causes which? The interaction between the ocean driving the winds, or is it the winds driving the oceans? Is not something we've really been able to figure out yet. So we can't forecast that one is going to occur in May, but when they start, we can see them happening.
Interesting. And what's our status now, by the way?
Last time I checked, they were looking at it's going into a La Nina type year, which is good for us in the sense that if we were going into an El Nino, that really has impact on snowfall in the upper Midwest. The fact that we're not going into an El Nino is a really good thing, I think.
So we'll have more snowfall then?
We'll have at least not below normal.
Okay.
I don't want to predict more snowfall, but predict not above normal or not below normal.
Not below normal. Okay, which we've had below normal.
For a number of years, yeah.
For a number of years, so we could use that moisture.
We could definitely use that moisture.
Mary in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
Good. I have seen a phenomenon in the sky with clouds, and the clouds actually look like cotton balls. I've only seen it once or twice, and I was just wondering, it's kind of an ominous-looking sky, too, and I was just wondering what that was.
We were just talking about the cloud types, and so when you talk about things that are like cotton ball-shaped, then you're usually talking about cumulus-type clouds. And if they're low-level clouds, like if it looks like they're pretty close to the ground, okay. Then those are probably what we call cumulus or even popcorn Q, because in a satellite image, they kind of look like popcorn scattered around. And generally, they're not too ominous. Generally, they're an indication of fair weather. So that was actually another name for them, is fair weather cumulus.
Okay.
It's when sometimes when you get those cotton ball ones that are up in the spring and fall that are in the middle and high levels, they sometimes are heralding that a front is coming. So even though it kind of looks nice, it generally means something's coming.
These are almost like right over your head, and they're kind of hanging there. And instead of the roundness being at the top of the clouds, it's layered on the bottom of the clouds.
Yeah. Oh, now, is the cloud generally overcast? I mean, is there a lot of cloud, or is it just scattered, puffy?
No, a lot.
Ah, okay. So I was thinking of something else. When you said that roundedness at the bottom, that reminded me of that signals another cloud type, which we call mammatus. And those are usually completely opposite of the fair weather cue.
Yeah.
So everything I just told you, erase. So those mammatus type clouds, they're like bag-like structures. Mm-hmm. And usually they're falling out of, or they're coming out of, thunderstorms. So, those are very ominous type of clouds. They definitely are indicating that there is a thunderstorm occurring in your area.
Okay, so go in the house instead of standing out and looking at them.
Well, I would still look until I start hearing lightning. Then I would go in the house. Because you're right, you don't see them a lot, and they're beautiful when they occur.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. I'd watch them out the window.
Oh, watch them out the window. That's another good thing.
I remember seeing some of those driving in northern Wisconsin. They were almost, as you looked ahead, it looked like they were almost level with some of the high hills that we were coming at, and they were going fast, and they were dark, and they were not friendly looking at all.
The ones that I'm reflecting now when I see them, a lot of times it's around sunset, so they're illuminated by the sun also in very interesting ways that they're actually beautiful, but they're saying something nasty's happening someplace.
Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 as we talk climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're talking climate and weather now with our guest, Professor Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Really happy to have him along today, and glad to have you listening in as well. And certainly we hope you'll join in with your questions. I know we're going to be talking about rainbows a little bit. We'll talk about the relationship between sun and wind. We've got that. We can talk some more about clouds. And normally this time of the year, we see some bad weather, and we haven't seen much of that. We haven't had many tornadoes, I don't think, in Wisconsin this year. Hardly at all, and maybe I'll ask him about why that's the case. If you have a question that's kind of bugging you, I hope you'll join in. Here's the number to call. It's 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll be right back after the news. We're talking climate and weather today with Steve Ackerman, one of our weather guys. He's a professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Always fun to have him along. He comes by the last Monday of every month, usually with Professor John Martin, but John's otherwise indisposed today.
So I'm sure he would rather be here.
I probably would. I'm pretty sure of that, too. Anyway, if you want to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1234, and in the Madison area at 263-1890. Bob in Dakota, Minnesota, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Haze. Or smog, if you want to call it that, whatever. I'm a landscape photographer, and I do quite a bit of aerial photography, and I'm always looking for ideal conditions. And once you get up in a plane, even though it looks like a very clear day, off in the distance, most of the time, there's quite a bit of haze. And so I'm always going on the Internet to the National Weather Service and talking to the folks here at the La Crosse National Weather Service Station. And it seems like real high-pressure systems when they first come in, and especially if they're coming down from Canada. But it seems like it's more complex. And I'm just wondering little things I should be watching for to get those really crisp days where you can see 30, 40 miles and you know, have it pristine?
Oh, boy, that's a good thing. That's a good question. And I guess things that I would look for are the day before, kind of look for breezy conditions, not real strong winds, but I'm thinking breezy conditions because that's an indication that you won't have this high pressure system over you. And what the high pressure system does is you have sinking air motion, so it kind of traps everything down low. And so, you know, if you have breezy conditions, that's going to kind of clear that out. And then usually at the nighttime, the winds will decouple from the surface, so it'll get calm, and any aerosols that are in there will settle out. The other thing I'd look for is low relative humidities. Haze in particular, you know, you really see it in the summertime because the relative humidities get so high. So if you look for low relative humidities or just really low dew points, you know, in the 50s, 40s, that's going to minimize the size of the particles and the development of the haze.
So those... you're saying that, I understand looking at it the day before for breezy conditions, but you're saying then the day that you're looking to do the photography, it seems like high pressure systems are fairly, are usually better, but are you saying that they can trap moisture down? Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So the good thing about high pressure conditions is that the winds are generally calm. And so you won't have the winds lifting up aerosols into the atmosphere and therefore reduce visibility. The bad thing, particularly in the summertime, the high-pressure systems will have a kind of a sinking motion. And so all that moist, humid air down near the ground tends to stay around.
Hmm. Okay.
And the other thing I would do is do it early in the morning.
It seems like, I don't know, I've tried morning, midday and afternoon, and it seems like you can also have it in the morning, but it seems like it's the toughest one, you know, to predict is that haze level.
Yep, and I think you're doing the right thing by talking to local National Weather Service forecasters for sure, because they'll know about local conditions.
Okay.
And what about time of year? Have you noticed it better in the fall, visibility?
Yeah, it is. It seems like summer is the tough time in particular.
Right, yep.
And the hot weather, and it seems like in the fall, if we have a high-pressure system coming down from Canada, typically that can be pretty good. Although it's not 100%, but...
Yeah. The thing about coming out of Canada, there's two things. One is, that form the haze. One is what we call cloud condensation nuclei. So they're basically little particles in the air where the water can condense onto. And then in the fall, or high-pressure systems coming out of Canada generally have a low humidity. And so those CCNs, cloud condensation nuclei, don't activate. They don't turn on the haze particles. So that's kind of the stuff you're looking for.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you much.
Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. Ann in McHenry, Illinois, you're next. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have just kind of a curiosity question. I was observing a rainbow not too long ago with some kids, and the question came up as to the shape of the rainbow. Do you get different shapes, or is it pretty much just the same arc that goes across the sky? Are there environmental or atmospheric conditions that can make it maybe broader and lower somehow, or is it pretty much always the same shape?
It's pretty much always the same shape in the sense that it's a bow shape. And that happens because the raindrops are spherical in nature. In terms of their shape. Mm-hmm. And so that three-dimensional structure of the raindrops that the light's interacting with is what's going to give you your bow-shaped. Now, depending on where you are and where the sun is, it may look like that rainbow can, go up higher and lower in the sky. Uh-huh. And so if it gets lower in the sky, it's like taking a circle and just kind of moving it up and down.
Mm.
As it gets lower, you'll just see the top, and so it may look flatter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling in. And Jim in Keewaskum, your turn now. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I have a question regarding tornadoes. I was wondering if there are any geological or geographical features of a town that make it more susceptible to a tornado touchdown. And the reason I ask that is I've often heard that some towns are more prone to having a tornado touchdown. Is there any truth in that?
I'm going to say yes and no.
Okay.
And here's why. Because when I'm thinking of two things when you ask that question. In the one case, if you're talking about a particular town and the geography and the area around that particular town, then the answer is no. Okay. That the, you know, little bluffs or lakes or isthmus, being on an isthmus, those really don't affect where the tornado is going to touch down. By then, by the time the tornado is coming, it's already well established and small okay. features aren't going to change it. However, if you look on the large scale and you look at where do most tornadoes occur, of course, they occur in the Mississippi Valley, upper Midwest of the U.S., Tornado Alley. And one of the reasons why it occurs here so frequently happens to do with geography or geology. The fact that you have the high plains to the west and the Mississippi Valley sucking up moisture from the Gulf region makes it so that the geology helps to generate rotations in clouds, which leads to the tornadoes.
Okay.
So if you happen to have a town that's located in a tornado alley, then I would say, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You are influenced by it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. Kathy in Denmark, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This has been driving me insane for like 2 months. I was watching the sky one day, and a jet had gone over, and there was a contrail that went from east to west, and there were like what I used to call mare's tails clouds, little wispy things in the sky, that were going from west to east, and the clouds were moving swiftly. The contrail wasn't moving at all. It just stayed there as clouds went under it and over it. And why does the contrail not move?
What direction was the contrail going?
The contrail was going from east to west, and the clouds were going from west to east.
Ah, okay. So there's two things that might contribute to that. One is that the contrail may actually be moving, but you can't see it because it's moving in the same direction with the mare's tails. The other, and this is probably more likely, is that when you see those mare's tails, you know, they have that mm-hmm. comet shape to it, that usually indicates that there's wind shear in the atmosphere in the upper levels, which means it's blowing really strongly in one area and not in another. So it may have been that the jet aircraft is flying above the jet stream or where the strong winds are and actually in pretty calm air. And then where you're seeing the mare's tails form is actually where the winds are strong.
Oh, that was just driving me nuts.
Yeah. And I'll bet it's that latter case because, you know, jets generally aren't going to want to fly into those strong winds
yep.
to conserve fuel.
Thank you so much.
We saved your sanity. Right?
Thanks, Kathy. Saved one person's sanity. Let's go to Dan and find out what's on his mind. Hi, Dan and Osseo.
Hi. Last week I had a question about a thunderstorm that went by our area, and as I was standing outside looking at it, which I know is not the smartest thing to do with a thunderstorm, but I was watching the storm, and I noticed little wispy clouds kind of at the bottom. They were turning clockwise, and then there'd be another one turning counterclockwise. Was that kind of the indication of a tornadic activity, or what possibly might have been going on with that?
It could be. Usually if you're watching a storm and you're noticing low-level clouds are going into the storm in a direction that makes it look like their rotation, generally that is a sign that the thunderstorm could become a severe thunderstorm, which
okay.
means it could do a tornado or large hail or strong winds. Generally it's a sign of, uh-oh. That's not good. Did it get severe weather? Did you get hail?
It was all around us, but actually right over my house, it kind of split and went around us. But it was just very interesting to watch those clouds.
Yeah. Yeah, seeing rotation in the bottom of a cloud generally means, yeah.
It's so, not a good idea.
Right, it's not generally thing. Not a good idea. But by my standards, some people want to see tornadoes and they're all excited about it. But me, I see rotation and I think, uh-oh,
Nuh-uh.
I'm going to the basement.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And Eric and Cashton, your turn now. Hi, Eric.
Hi there. This is kind of in addition to the caller two calls ago about the contrails. I've seen a lot of stuff on the Internet about the difference between contrails and chemtrails. I want to know if you are familiar with chemtrails. Just seeing that's like government experiments at regulating weather and contrails. After the plane passes, the contrails disappear after a while. And the chemtrails tend to they use chemicals to spray to create clouds. And if you watch chemtrails after a while, they tend to spread and create bigger clouds. They don't go away. I was just wondering if you know anything about chemtrails. And then also another quick question. What solid scientific proof have you seen about man-made global warming? Because I've seen a lot of stuff about the fact that the oceans hold the majority of the CO2 in our atmosphere, and they tend to release the CO2 after the planet has warmed, and this is recorded through with ice core samples. So I was just wondering, because Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth, he tries to claim that the CO2 levels raise the temperature, and the research I've seen has kind of flopped the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so with the climate first, there's still a lot of things we don't know with regard to the interaction of the atmosphere and the ocean and how the ocean is going to behave as the atmosphere warms and cools. So there's a lot of research going on right now, and some of that is with regard to, as you were pointing out, take up of carbon dioxide, as well as releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as well as circulation patterns. You know, as we're seeing melting of the glaciers up on Greenland, for example, whether or not that fresh water as it comes into the ocean is going to modify oceanic circulations is another area where there's a lot of active research going on. But in terms of the global warming and the evidence for the global warming, there is multiple of evidence from both ice core sampling, as you pointed out, in terms of global warming occurring, the instrumentation record that we have, as well as observations that people have been making with regard to growing season length or ice on the lakes and things like that.
But his question was, is man-made global warming?
I think, again, the evidence is that we are contributing to the global warming in terms of anthropogenic activities, in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting out. Now, the interactions of that in terms of what's going to happen for the next 50 years or 100 years when we start talking about what's the ocean going to respond to that, those are the parts that we don't know a lot about or we're still doing a lot of work on.
What about these chemtrails?
They're kind of, I'm not going to get into trouble for saying this, but they're paranoia. There aren't such things as chemtrails. What he was describing with regard to the contrails spreading out, that's actually what we do observe. Sometimes contrails don't, if you're following the jet, contrails, sometimes you won't even see them. And that means that the atmospheric conditions weren't right to form. Sometimes you'll see them, but they'll be really, really small. So they just dry up and evaporate. Other times, and usually if you're just on the border of a cirrus cloud system that's coming in to your area, but you don't see them, you know, they haven't generated, naturally hasn't generated a cloud. These contrails will stay around for a long time and then actually spread out. So that spreading that we see is actually just normal contrails. And I know this because we did an experiment, me and a bunch of NASA people and university people studying contrail development back in the mid-1990s. And one of the things we would do is we'd fly up there in an area where we knew contrails would form. So we weren't spraying anything. We were just flying jets up in an area. And we would send the jets around in circular patterns in order to, you know, contrails would form in that way. And then this way we could actually track them. And you could watch them over 4 or 5 hours. Sometimes they will just, you know, maintain that circular racetrack pattern, and they'll just slowly spread out and eventually occupy the sky as it moves into other cirrus clouds. And in fact, you could also see that. I mean, the other interesting part of that is that during the first Gulf War in 91, you could look at weather satellites over Saudi Arabia and see the same type of pattern. And, you know, you knew right away, oh, okay, so there's some aircraft that's circling around. I wonder what that could be doing.
All right, Eric, I thank you very much for calling. I want to give some others a chance here. And Andy in New London, you are next. Hi, Andy.
Howdy. I just had a brief question about a small funnel cloud. I was driving past, it was almost like a gravel road, and I saw almost looked like a tornado, but it was about 10 feet tall, and it was just spewing gravel around. It was just a very small funnel cloud, and I was wondering what would cause a tornado that small and how those go about forming, and I'll just listen to my answer on the radio.
Before you go, though, was there a thunderstorm in the area, or was it clear sky?
It was a perfectly clear day.
Okay, yeah. That's what we call a dust devil. And generally, the difference is, in general terms, from tornadoes come from a cloud base downward, and so you have rotation going on. inside the cloud. In the dust devils, it's usually generated near the surface, and it's due to gradients and heating of the different surfaces. And you see this a lot in the Southwest, where you get really dry deserts and you get really strong heating of the surface. I haven't seen one around in in Wisconsin, so it's pretty cool that you'd see one, particularly that big. You see a lot of dust, you know, little whirlwinds, but the ones that I've seen around here are generally, you know, at biggest maybe 2 feet. But see something at 10 feet, that'd be cool.
Out toward Yuma, Arizona, so I spent some time driving from Phoenix to Yuma on several occasions. I would see some that were much taller than 10 feet.
Oh, yeah. The ones out in Arizona can get up to hundreds of feet even. Yeah, they get really big.
And sometimes several of them in one field.
Oh, really? Wow.
It was pretty cool. No, I had my camera. You know, I was going along.
Just try to drive and get someplace.
Oh, man. Hallie, by the way, has emailed us a question. She's wondering about the ozone layers over the poles. Some years ago, there was a lot of discussion about the one over the South Pole especially. Has it stabilized? Is it now considered part of the general climate warming phenomena? What's the deal with the ozone layers over the poles?
Boy, you know, I have not looked at that recently. And now's the time to be looking at it because it's their wintertime in terms of the extent of the ozone hole. I know, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, there was hope that the size of the ozone hole was decreasing. You know, so over the years, we've been seeing an increase. And then a couple of years ago, we thought we saw a decrease. But it had to do not with the amount of ozone, but actually had to do with a change in the temperature of the stratosphere due to some odd circulation patterns. And so that must have been 2 years ago, because last year, the size of the ozone hole was again back to being as big as expected. But I haven't looked at it this year. I should look at that for next time.
David in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, David.
Yes. Your previous caller who was talking about rainbows triggered a little story. I was teaching on the Wisconsin Lake schooner Dennis Sullivan a week ago Sunday, and we saw an upside-down rainbow. In other words, like a smile as opposed to an arch.
Now,
trying to explain this to people as being... it's sort of like a glory, if you know what a glory
is.
Yeah,
right, yep.
But you usually have to be in an airplane to see a glory because you're looking down into your own shadow.
Right, yep.
Whereas we were looking into the sun and there was a rainbow arching under the sun, the bottom half.
Ah, so you were looking into the sun.
Yeah, we were looking towards it. Okay. It would be like a ring around the moon.
Right, yeah, okay.
Except it was the sun. It was a distinct rainbow.
Yeah, that is... that is generated by ice crystals, not by raindrops. Mm. And usually the way you know is if in rainbows, the sun is always behind you.
Yes, right.
And in when you look...
too.
Say that again?
In glories.
And in glories, too. That's right. So when you're looking towards the sun, it's much more common to see those sun dog features,
right,
which are generated by ice crystals. But occasionally you'll also see things called circumzenithical arcs. And those occur up near the top and the bottom of a
Say that term again.
Yeah, that's going to be hard for me to say again. Circumzenithal arcs.
Zenithal arcs.
Yeah.
Circumzenithal arcs, meaning circle around the sun.
Right, and they're usually at the zenith, above and below.
Mm-hmm.
And they're generated by particular ice crystals, much like the sun dogs are, but generally. You get much more distinct colors in those things than you do in sun dogs. Like you could see the reds and the blues easily.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. I've only seen those once in my life, so it's pretty cool that you saw it.
First time I ever saw it, too, and we had a whole boatload of folks see it, which...
which is nice.
I stood there as the teacher trying to explain what was happening. Now I know what it's called.
Right, yeah. So I would look it up. They'll probably have some really good diagrams that demonstrate it. And... play around with various combinations.
Okay.
Thanks,
Dave. Spelling.
Thanks, David. John in Rosendale. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a question about a comment made at the beginning of the show that cloud classification types are at a lower altitude at the poles. Is that what you said?
No. Well, yeah, I probably said that, but that's not quite what I meant. In terms of the ranges of the altitude of where the low-level clouds would be. So we may be saying low-level clouds, in the I'll give examples, although I'm going to probably get them wrong. In polar regions, low-level clouds may be clouds below, say, 6,500 feet. In the tropics, we'll say low-level clouds are clouds below 8,000 feet. That's what I meant.
Oh, is that going to change with climate change?
Boy, that's a good question. I would think probably not too much, because that change is really based on the depth of the troposphere. The troposphere is that region of the atmosphere where all the weather occurs. And in the polar regions, it's generally a lot smaller. Like the top of that troposphere, what we call the tropopause, is maybe at 30,000 feet. Whereas in the tropics, that altitude would probably be more like 45,000 feet.
Okay. Thanks, John. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Steve, thank you.
Boy, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, it went by pretty quickly.
It sure did. Is,
and you'll be back the last Monday?
Of August.
Of August.
The 27th, I think, or the 28th.
Cool. We'll look forward to it. Thank you. Steve Ackerman is a professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he usually, with John Martin, joins us the last Monday of every month to talk climate and weather. And we'll do it again in August. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a survey of business executives conducted by RSM McGladrey, and then we'll take a look at cameras with Brian Carlos of the Camera Company. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.